Committee on Land Use for Wednesday, June 8th. Good afternoon, committee. We have some members attending the special Mark Hatfield, and they'll be joining us when that presentation is over. Committee, we have been, Sam has been presented today with dash fives, dash sixes, and dash sevens, which you may or may not have copies, and we understand now that there are eight and nines that may be on the way. We're going to start today with the dash threes, and I would ask those parties that are involved with the dash three amendments to come forward, and we'll get going. The quick and very acute mind that you always were as a representative, you don't need a warning on who you're up there with.
The light goes on and off we go. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lane Shetterly, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development, here at the table with John Chandler and Dave Honeycutt to present to you at least a brief statement, an overview of what we have, I hope, distributed as a summary of dash three amendments to House Bill 3120, June 8th version. That's new legislative nomenclature. Probably what this means is that these will ultimately be the dash 10s, 11s, 12s, or something like that. But they, so I wouldn't spend a lot of time trying to tie these in specifically the dash threes. Do we also have copies of the full text distributed available? I'm not sure, Mr. Chair, but have you seen the full text? It says
dash three
proposed amendments to the House Bill 3120 replaces the dash three amendments?
No.
Here they come. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as you know from my previous appearances and the appearances of others before the committee, since Senate Bill 1037 started making its way through the Senate, there have been ongoing discussions among representatives of cities, counties, Oregonians in Action, home builders, Metro, and myself on behalf of the department and the governor's office. Regarding proposed amendments to ballot measure 37, and what you have before you in the replacement version for the dash three amendments represents the status, the current iteration of those discussions. What you'll find in here, I think I would be it would be fair to say it represents agreement on 90 to 93% of the of what you have in this draft. There's still not among the group that has been discussing these unanimous agreement or consensus. That effort is still ongoing, but we believe that we have presented with this something that the committee can look at as representing consensus largely, I should say, of those of us who have been dealing with this.
Hopefully we won't get to the point where there's a time marked.
Mr. Chair, those amendments are actually
out there. 9:35 a.m.
Yes, that's correct. We tried to spare you that version. So what I will do is just indicate the interest of the Department and the Governor's Office to continue on this course to assist the committee in addressing key issues and developing a consensus in the legislature to move forward on Ballot Measure 37. Mr. Chandler and Mr. Honeycutt, I think, will express similar sentiments, and then we would invite Glenn Klein and Dan Cooper to come forward. Glenn, who, as you may know, is an attorney from Eugene who works with the League of Oregon Cities. Dan Cooper is an attorney for Metro in Portland, and they can take you through more of the detail of this.
thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Homebuilders Association, and you heard from me the other day. I'll be extremely brief this morning, other than to say this, I think, is shaping into something I would recommend to you for adoption. It's a good compromise, I believe, between the various interests represented by the Major 37 discussions. It's not quite done, as Director Shetterly indicated, but it's right close to something that we would be handing to you and asking for your support and movement through the system. It's been a very fascinating process, having with the veteran of Major 7 discussions. This, in some ways, was more difficult because it was more pressing. It wasn't a Major 7. We had the question mark ultimately answered by the Supreme Court whether or not Major 7 would, in fact, kick in or not. As it turned out, it did not. With Major 37, we have the fact that it is the law today, and while there are varying interpretations of what it means, the fact is it was passed, it is on the books, and whatever the courts, should it come to that, might determine as its interpretation is what we all have to live with as a state, my industry, each of you, or our communities. The attempt we've all made with this work group on these amendments is to sheathe the swords, put aside the preconceptions to the extent it's possible to do so, and talk through a way to address what was done in Major 37 in a way that was workable and fair and still left the land use system as intact, as an intact form. I think we'll be able to recommend them to you. I look forward to coming back and doing just that. And one, with my name, Mr. Chairman, on the issue of the compensation piece, which does not appear in here, I've talked with several of you, so just as long as I'm up here, give you a quick report. I'm waiting for a call back from the Legislative Council as to a bill that's in this committee with a relating clause that may or may not work to accommodate a separate bill that we would suggest accompany this proposal for the initial establishment of a compensation fund. So hopefully, as soon as we're done here, I'll get Dr. Legislative Council to give an answer.
I think the committee would compliment you on that objective as you started off on this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. We, and I'll be even, I think, briefer than, or more brief than Director Shetterly and Mr. Chandler, other than to indicate that we have been involved with this process, as you're probably aware, that there's no secret in the Capitol, excuse me, for quite some time, and are very, I would say Director Shetterly's being a little pessimistic, rather than being somewhere between 90% and 93% done. I'd say we're closer to 98% done and maybe a little higher. Very optimistic that we will, that the folks that have been working on this for months now will come up with a package that we can all present to you, hold hands and say this is where we are and this is what we all agree to. I would ask that you pay close attention if you can to Mr. Klein and Mr. Cooper as they walk you through a lot of the language. It's certainly a more detailed draft than Measure 37, which is appropriate since it's a legislative draft as opposed to an initiative, so it's long and detailed. But I think you can take, I hope you'll take my word for it, that every subsection of that draft has been debated and discussed and argued about and I think the draft represents a fine product and something that deserves your consideration. And if we come back in a day or two and say we're ready to go, hopefully your adoption at that point.
Any questions in the panel?
Mr. Chair, and I thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure whether you three or the two attorneys who will follow are the right folks to answer this question. But the question is,
how about I do?
Since we're not sitting here, they get to answer it. I am interested, and I think it would benefit the committee if we could have some, not exactly precise, but order of magnitude assessment of the various impacts of the different sections of what you're proposing. I'm a visual person. Maps do wonderful things for me to be able to see the impact on the ground, as you were, as it, of some of the elements of what you're proposing. And if not maps, then some other mechanism for us to get our arms around what this affects, how big the impact is, how many landowners, how many neighbors, how many counties, how much acreage. I don't know what the right measurement or depiction of it is. Mm-hmm. And so somewhere in what you're doing, either today or sometime in the next few days, if there's some way for you to help us understand not just the words on the page, but what it, how it plays out in Oregon communities, that would help tremendously.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, we'll do our best to come up with something that helps in a visual way, and at least compare this to ballot measure 37, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I think it's going to be hard with these amendments and truly with any other amendments to quantify the differences, because so much of measure 37 is still prospective. And what claims are out there are known really only to the claimants, and for us to drill down to that level of detail, you truly would have to go out and research property titles on a parcel-by-parcel basis to know what the potential impacts might be, and then measure that, those potential impacts under Measure 37 against the potential impacts here. We don't have the time or resources to do that level of detail, but we'll do our best to at least highlight where the significant differences are between this and ballot Measure 37, and where the puts and takes are.
And Mr. Chair, if I might just follow up, and that's what I'm looking for, Mr. Shetterly. Current law, Measure 37, compared with what this does to it.
Right.
Thanks.
Yeah,
I have a question for the Chair. Will you be having this panel come back after we've had the...
Would the panel make itself available, or?
Staying at the table, Mr. Hennigan.
No, I wasn't going to stay at the table.
We will all be in the room, unless the questions are too hard, in which case we'll leave.
Okay. Thank you. Director Shetterly will come along.
Yeah, this is the room we're coming out of, in which case we're all busy.
Put yourself under a call of the chair.
Under room arrest.
Yes, right. You know, bar the doors and...
See you again.
Okay, boys.
Nice try.
I better re-summon.
Nice try, Dave. Good afternoon, John.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Glenn Klein with Harang Long, here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities, and with me, of course, is Dan Cooper, General Counsel for Metro.
And I'd just like to add for the record that the three gentlemen who were in front of you are all members of the Oregon State Bar, too.
Backerman, would you make note of that?
Please do.
I'd like to.
Mr. Chair, with your permission, what we thought we might do is just walk through the summary as opposed to walking through the bill page by page, and certainly we can get into as much detail as you would like. If I could step back for just a moment with a sort of a 30-second answer, Representative Nolan, to sort of your what's this really do? Here's the best way I can describe it, at least in 30 seconds. What it does is to guarantee transferability, so it fixes that in a way to make sure that when property owners receive waivers, that those waivers are transferable. It establishes a claims process and judicial review provisions so that we don't have to go litigate how that stuff works. Mm-hmm. And then it, in my view, significantly limits the scope of Measure 37 in terms of the kinds of claims that people can bring, the kinds of uses they may be able to make of the property. And when we get into the summary, talking about what can happen inside the urban growth boundary and what can happen in the rural area, that's where you'll see how that scope is limited. But that's sort of my overview of what the bill, big picture, really does. And now for some of the more details. And do you have a copy of the summary? It's summary of dash three amendments.
Yes.
then what Dan and I will do is just walk through that, and we'd be happy to entertain questions if you have them. The first part of the bill, Section 1, deals with the existing claims that have been filed and what under Measure 37. And what we did was to say those claims that are filed prior to March 15th would or could proceed under old Measure 37 at the property owner's discretion. If the property owner wanted to withdraw the claim and refile it under, in essence, new Measure 37, the property owner would have the right to do that. What the property owner would get by withdrawing and refiling under the new measure is transferability, and under the old measure, the question of transferability is going to get decided sooner or later by the courts. But if they want certainty in terms of transferability, then they can withdraw their claim and refile it under the new measure. If they refile it under the new measure, they're, of course, subject to all of the provisions under the new measure. For those claims filed after March 15th, this says those claims would be deemed withdrawn and those individuals would need to file under the new measure.
Mr. Klein, if someone has filed a claim, given this scenario, would not the transferability issue, if the new Measure 37 gives transferability, why would it not give it to everyone on a legal basis who had filed?
Mr. Chair, the way... I'm not sure whether your question is a policy question or a legal question. In terms of the legalities, the way the bill is drafted, the transferability provisions only apply to those claims that are filed under the new measure, so they're subject to the claims process provisions, okay. The claims information, and those sorts of things.
So there's a different procedure and, in essence, a different claim to be filed.
But, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
Now, the one exception... to that in terms of transferability, and this is jumping to the end of the bill.
And I didn't mean to do that to you, by the way. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to make you jump around.
Mr. Chair, it's probably just as easy for me to address this right now. Section 26, what Section 26 of the bill would do is to provide that for anyone who filed a claim prior to March 15th, filed that claim with a county as well as the state, and received decisions to grant, in essence, waivers prior to June 1st, those waivers would be subject to the new transferability provisions. So if somebody went through that process, who's already received their waivers, then those waivers would be transferable. The one person that I'm aware of that has done that, and Director Shelley can tell you if there are perhaps others, but the one person that I'm aware of that has done that is Dorothy English. So that the waivers, under the way this is drafted, the waivers that she has already received would be transferable. We did make, going back to Section 1 in Old Measure 37, we are proposing to make some changes to Old Measure 37. And those changes relate to the claim, or to the judicial review provisions for those claims. We didn't say anything about how the claims process ought to work because a lot of those claims are already in process or have been processed. But there are a number of questions under the old measure as to how judicial review of those claims ought to work. And in our conversations between Dave and John Chandler and the governments, what we decided is nobody would really be disadvantaged if we said, here's how judicial ought to work. What we could do is avoid a bunch of litigation as to whether a judicial review proceeding should be under, if it's a state agency, under the Administrative Procedures Act, whether it should be filed as a declaratory judgment, writ of review. And so we tried to clarify that and say, if anybody wants judicial review of a claim that had been filed prior to March 15th, then here's how it would work. And basically what we said is those claims would get filed in circuit court and they would proceed as a declaratory judgment action. One of the other changes that we made in old Measure 37 was to make it clear I guess we Bill finally got there.
$1,000 over there, and they wouldn't have moved any faster.
The other change that we made to old Measure 37 was to make explicit what the Attorney General's Office, I believe, has said is implicit, which is that state agencies have the authority to waive claims based on state statutes, so as to not to have to litigate that issue or put the legislature in the position of having to come into session every 90 days to actually make decisions. We made explicit that state agencies do have that authority. That's Section 1, and that's how we dealt with old Measure 37. The balance of the bill basically is sort of the new Measure 37. Section 3 of the bill contains the definitions. Those definitions are very similar to the definitions that were in Senate Bill 1037 that are in your Dash 1 amendments. So I'm not going to talk about those. Section 4 of the bill specifies sort of the scope of the measure, the real guts of the measure. In subsection 1, we specify when somebody would have a claim, and we differentiate between new land use regulations and existing land use regulations. Sometimes people talk about prospective claims versus retroactive claims. New land use regulations would be a land use regulation that would be adopted after the effective date of this legislation. The old land use regulations or retroactive claims would be for land use regulations that are existing as of the effective date of this legislation. For a new land use regulation, somebody would have a claim if the government enacts that new land use regulation, if the land use regulation restricts the use of the property, reduces the fair market value of the property, and does not fall within one of the exemptions. And so that provision is very similar to what's in the current Measure 37. So in terms of the scope for prospective claims, that scope is pretty much the same as the existing measure. The only difference becomes in how some of the exemptions are defined, and I'll mention that in just a minute. For retroactive claims, and so it's that sub B at the bottom of page 1 of the summary, somebody would have a retroactive claim, again, if it first met those same tests. It has to, the regulation has to restrict the use of property, has to reduce the fair market value, cannot be exempt under one of the exemptions, and then in addition, it has to meet another test depending on, and the test depends on whether it's inside the urban growth boundary or outside the urban growth boundary. And I'm going to deal with those when we get to those sections of the bill, which is sections 14 and 18. Turning to page 2, subsection 2 deals with the exemptions. The exemptions are pretty much the same as the original measure, except there are some clarifications to some of the exemptions. The exemption for regulations required by federal law has been clarified, and there is an additional exemption that's not in Measure 37 that relates to coastal shorelands west of Highway 101. And if you want to see that on page 7 of the bill itself, there's a new paragraph F. And so a regulation would be exempt if it applies to coastal shorelands west of Highway 101, as well as estuaries, beaches, or dunes, as those terms are currently defined. So if the definitions, if LCDC changes the definitions in the future, that wouldn't affect this exemption. The exemption just relates to what's in place today.
But that would affect any claim that had been filed to this point?
Dave, do you know?
Mr. Chair, Dave Honeycutt, I don't believe that we have an answer to that question. That Director Shutterly might, but I'm not sure. Okay.
Moving on, subsection 3, so at the top of page 3, specifies the timelines for when claims would have to be filed under the new measure. And again, it differentiates between prospective claims and retroactive claims. For prospective claims, the claim would have to be filed within 5 years of adoption of that new land use regulation, or within 21 days of the date that that new land use regulation is used as an approval criterion for a land use application, whichever is earlier. So, for example, if a government adopts a new land use regulation on January 1 of 2006, property owner comes in on July 1 of 2006 with a land use application, and that application is denied, based on that new land use regulation, the property owner would have to file their claim within 21 days of the date of that land use decision. And the reason for that 21 days is so that the Measure 37 claim can get resolved before the land use decision goes up to LUBA. If the land use regulation isn't applied to the property through that land use application process, then the property owner would have 5 years from the date that the government adopted that new land use regulation to bring a claim. For retroactive claims, those based on regulations in effect today, a claim would have to be filed by September 1st of 2006. So they would have approximately 15 months, to file that claim. One of the reasons why a date in that general area was chosen, sort of the middle of 2006, is so that we would have all of the retroactive claims filed and at least in process prior to the next time that you meet. The goal here is to understand sort of the breadth of claims that we're going to get and the amount of compensation that might be required if a decision is to pay compensation as opposed to waive. So by having that September 1st date before you meet next, at least in regular session, we would have a pretty good understanding as to the magnitude of those claims. Subsection 4 is intended to address to a certain extent how the reduction in value should work and what our work group as well as a couple other work groups really wound up concluding is it's very difficult to do that through legislation. We can set some general standards through legislation, and what we're recommending to you is that the detail be provided through administrative rulemaking by the Department of Administrative Services. And then subsection 5 just makes it clear that public entities have the authority to waive, that state agencies have the authority to waive, so long as the claims are valid. That would be both the state and local governments. And that the extent of the waiver is limited to that which is necessary to allow the property owner to use the property in a way that the property owner could have used it at the time that the property owner acquired it. So again, going back to what Measure 37 currently provides, it's not a blanket waiver. This wouldn't allow local governments or the state government to simply say, oh, we don't like that regulation, let's just get rid of it through this process. Instead, a waiver could only be granted if a valid claim was presented, and the waiver would be limited to a use that the property owner could have made when the property owner acquired it. Sections 5 through 7 of the bill deals with the claims process. Claims process is very similar to what was in SB 1037 and what was in your Dash 1 amendments. I can certainly walk through it if you would like. If you've already had people walk through it because of the Dash 1 amendments, then I won't do it now. What's, Mr. Chair, your preference?
What's the committee's preference? I don't think we've ever had anybody walk us through the claims process. Okay. So,
then let me do that. What the claims process is intended to do is to spell out how a claim gets filed, how a government gives notice and decides the claim, and then how judicial review happens. And in doing that, what we tried to do was answer all of the questions that people have been asking over the last 6, 7, 8 months about how this should work, And so we tried to spell that out, just like SB 1037 did. What the claims process initially provides is that an owner can file a claim, but they can only file, they have to bundle any of their claims, any of the regulations that they believe will result in a valid claim, they have to bundle those all into a single claim. So if somebody says, you know, the city of Eugene just adopted or in the past has adopted a bunch of regulations that affect me, the property owner would not be able to file a claim on January 1 for one regulation and then a different claim on February 1 for another regulation and so on. Instead, what the property owner would have to do for all of the regulations that are in effect as of the date that the application or the claim gets filed, the property owner is going to have to bundle those all into a single claim. If the property owner has a claim against the state as well as a county or as well as a city or metro, then they would file the claim, one claim with the state, one claim with metro, one claim with the city. So they bundle them all up for a single claim for a single jurisdiction. All of the owners have to approve the filing of that claim. So if you have a piece of property that has multiple owners, either they have to consent to the filing or they actually have to sign the claim. The government has, just like under Measure 37, 180 days in which to process the claim. When the claim comes in, notice of the claim needs, let me back up, this specifies, and it's on page 9 of the bill, it specifies what must be included in the claim itself. They provide name and address of the owner, address of the property, evidence of ownership, evidence as to when you acquired it. If your claim is based on family history, some evidence to demonstrate that the property has been continuously owned by a family member. You need to provide either, and the key here is either, a list or description of the land use regulations that the owner believes reduce the value, or you can provide a description of the specific use of the property that you want to make of it that you believe you could have made back when you acquired it, but you can't make it today. What we have attempted to do here is to make sure that we don't put the property owners in the position of having to try to guess as to every single regulation that may be preventing them from undertaking a particular use. We, the government side of this, have acknowledged that we're probably in a better position to say, well, you have to worry about these five regulations given the use that you want, but you have to tell us what you really want to do. So you can't just say, I'd like to do whatever I could have done back when I acquired the property. That would not be sufficient. But you could say, when I acquired this property, I could have built a house. I would like to build a house. And then the government can say, okay, that involves these three or four regulations. There has to be some evidence that the regulations have reduced the value of the property. And then there is a provision that says, along with the claim, with that claim information, a public entity can impose a fee that is capped at $1,000. The public entity doesn't have to impose that fee. It's going to be optional, but if the public entity wants to create a fee, they can, but the fee can't exceed $1,000. And then the process basically works, the next step of the process works similar to the land use application process where the government reviews the claim, determines whether it's complete. If it's not complete, the government gives notice to the property owner, say, we think it's missing this and this and this, and the property owner has the choice of saying, no, I think it's complete, go ahead and process it, or here's the additional information that you are requesting. Once the application is
here, excuse me for interrupting, but I just want to make sure I understood that, Mr. Klein. If in that situation the property owner says, no, I think it's complete, then the property owner essentially concludes the information the property owner presents and can't later then come and say, oh, I neglected to provide this information, or what's the status?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mellon, under that circumstance, the property owner could provide as part of the, in essence, either the public comment period or the public hearing, and I'll get into the difference there in a minute, but could provide additional information as part of that process. What this says is, as part of your application, you're supposed to include certain things. If you don't include it, then it's going to, one, make it very difficult for the government to be able to say, here's the regulations that you should be worried about, and so that will come back to bite the property owner down the road. And there are limitations on what people can raise once it gets to circuit court, depending on what they have said at the government stage. This would, though, allow somebody, a property owner, say, no, the application's to complete, and to provide some additional information during the public participation process.
Okay. Thank you.
Once the public entity has concluded that it has a complete claim, either because all the information that's provided needs to be in the government's view, or the property owner said, you have everything we think you need, the government then gives notice to the owners of the property, to everybody, and the reference here is to ORS 197-763, that deals with the land use application process, and what that generally requires is that notice be provided to individuals, owners, within a certain distance of the property. That distance depends on whether you are inside or outside the urban growth boundary. But owners of nearby properties would receive notice. If the claim went to a local government, then notice would also go to Department of Administrative Services. If the claim went to the state would provide notice to the local governments. The notice, and I'm now on page 11 if you're trying to follow along, the notice would have to describe what the claim is, and then in addition, it would identify whether the government intends to hold a public hearing or simply accept public comment. The government has to do one or the other. It can't just decide the claim without accepting some kind of information from the public. The public hearing requirement is optional. There are a number of cities, I'm not sure about counties, but certainly a number of cities that have public hearing requirements in their Measure 37 ordinances. Some of them will decide to hold public hearings. There are a number of local governments that have decided they don't want to have a public hearing, but they certainly want to receive public comment. Under the state's process, under the DAS rules, the state receives public comment. So this notice that would go out to people would say, here's what the claim is, and either there's a public hearing scheduled at such and such a time on this date, or it would say you can submit written testimony and evidence prior to X date. And again, this ties back to the land use application process in terms of if people want an extension to keep the record open a little bit longer, they can request that, and then the record would be kept open a little bit longer. If the record is kept open longer, that additional time period would not count as part of the 180 days. And so that protects both the property owner and the government. Once the record is closed, the government would then make its decision as to whether the claim is valid, whether it's going to grant compensation if it's valid, or whether it's going to waive a regulation. In that decision, if it's a decision to waive a regulation, the government will say specifically, here is the use that we are approving. So it's not that the regulation is simply going to go away even for that property, but instead what we are envisioning is that the waiver would say, you filed a claim that said you wanted to build a house on your property. Here's your waiver that says, notwithstanding these four regulations over here, those regulations no longer prevent you from building your house. That is different than saying that here's a piece of paper that says you get to build your house. Because there may be other requirements, either old regulations or new regulations that are exempt, which might prevent the property owner from building the house. If they have no access to water, septic, fire, those kinds of issues may still prevent the use from being undertaken. And so what the waiver really is something that essentially says, notwithstanding these regulations over here that we can waive, we waive those, but you still need to go through the other process to determine whether you can make that particular use of your property.
Glenn, could that in itself trigger another Measure 37 claim?
Mr. Chair, it should not, with one exception. The reason why the sort of the later application would not be approved is for one of two reasons. Either there's a regulation that was exempt, and so you wouldn't have a new Measure 37 claim because the regulation would still be exempt, or the government missed an old regulation that could have been waived. You know, when you file your claim, we said, okay, you want to build a house, looks like these four regulations are preventing you from doing that. We waive those. You come in a year later, 2 years later, and say, okay, now I want to build, and the government says, oops, there's this other regulation that also prevents you. What's written into this is something that says, in that circumstance, where the government missed something that could have been waived, then you as the property owner do have the right to file one more claim for that specific regulation. And that's to make sure that we don't have any oops or gotchas when the property owner says, here's the use that I want to make.
So if that were a local government that made that decision, mm-hmm. would its decision be binding on a state agency?
Mr. Chair, the way this is set up, I believe the answer to your question is yes. The way this is set up is that if what you are complaining about is a regulation enacted by a local government, then you must file your claim with the local government. If what you're complaining about is a regulation enacted by the state, then you have to file your claim with the state. If you are in the rural area, if you're outside the urban growth boundaries, my assumption is that Dave, as well as the Department of Land Conservation and Development, are going to continue, as they have in the past, to advise property owners that file claims in both places, because it's very possible that there are both state regulations and county regulations that impact you. So just file claims in both places. There's nothing in the bill that would allow, for example, if a local government waives a local regulation, there's nothing in the bill that would allow the state to say, wait a minute, local government, you can't waive that regulation. This is very clear that notwithstanding any state statute, any state administrative rule, that if a valid claim is presented to a local government or a state agency, that state agency or local government has the authority to waive.
Thank you.
Okay, so the local government or the state has issued the decision. A copy of the decision has to go to anybody who participated in the proceeding. So if you received the initial notice, or even if you didn't, if you participated in the proceeding by providing testimony at a public hearing or submitting written comment, then you will get copies or a copy of the decision. Section 7 of the bill, bottom of page 12 and goes on to page 13, is something that is an option that would allow an owner, and so it's an option at the owner's discretion, to submit, in essence, a combined or a joint land use application and Measure 37 claim. If you know exactly what you want to do, submit your land use application and say, here's my land use application. Now, in order to approve my land use application, you're going to need to waive a couple regulations, and here's my Measure 37 claim. So they could be filed together. What this provides is, if that happens, then the land use application proceeding is put on hold until the Measure 37 claim is decided. If a waiver is granted, then the land use application kicks up again. And we make sure that the 120 or 150 days that cities and counties have to deal with land use applications those provisions are also, or those statutes are told until the Measure 37 claim is completed. So that's the claims process, and then we get to judicial review. And the way judicial review is going to work, what we established here was a single process that would be applicable whether the claim was filed with a city, a county, metro, or the state. And this is now on page 13 of the bill. Oh, it starts there. What we wanted to do was not have the result that a property owner needed or somebody else needed to file one judicial review proceeding in circuit court for a local claim and a separate proceeding either in a circuit court or the state court of appeals for a state claim and have to work under writ of reviews and the Administrative Procedures Act. So we came up with a process that says somebody who wants to challenge the public entity's decision on whether it's a denial, granting compensation, or approval of a waiver, you would file that in the circuit court in the county in which the property is located. And that court has exclusive jurisdiction. So this wouldn't go to LUBA, but would instead go to circuit court. Anybody adversely affected by the decision could challenge the decision. Anybody adversely affected could also intervene in that proceeding. So initially, you know, let's say it's a denial, then the property owner would file the proceeding in circuit court, and other people who participated would have the ability to intervene to try to uphold the government's decision. Alternatively, if the government granted the waiver over the objections of, let's say, some neighbors, then the neighbor would be able to file the proceeding to seek judicial review of the government decision. The property owner would automatically be named, but anybody else who had also participated would be able to intervene in the proceeding.
Now, that scares me a little bit. So I think that's a concern that was exhibited during the interim when we traveled around the state, was to have parties that in essence had no standing in the land use decision being able to stop that decision from going forward.
Mr. Chair, the way we attempted to deal with that is by including the words somebody who was adversely affected. Those are words of magic in the Court of Appeals. If you're not adversely affected, depending on how the Supreme Court deals with a particular case that's before it, if you're not adversely affected, you may not have constitutional standing or the ability to file a suit. What we said is, in order to challenge, if you're the neighbor and you disagree with the decision to waive, you have to be adversely affected by that decision, and then all of the law that the courts have issued related to who is adversely affected will automatically be incorporated into how this would work.
I appreciate the way you explained that, because all the non-attorneys are up here.
I have a question. Just to follow up on that, can you give me an example of adversely affected, or how that is defined?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, currently there are two standards, adversely affected or aggrieved, and you see throughout the land use statutes the words adversely affected or aggrieved. Adversely affected has been interpreted by the court to require some type of showing of an actual concrete injury. So the person would have to show that would have to demonstrate with evidence that the impact of this particular decision has some type of concrete impact upon whatever their particular use of their property or something of that nature. So I believe, although I may be wrong, but I believe that the case law says that people within sight and sound of a proposed development are adversely affected. I believe that's a correct statement of the law. The word aggrieved has been interpreted by the court to mean anybody that disagrees with the decision and has some type for whatever reason, philosophical or otherwise, would then have standing. And so it's the, by eliminating the word aggrieved in this language, the attempt was to require a showing of some type of actual injury in order to obtain standing. And depending on how the Supreme Court decides in the Just case, it may very well be that that's a constitutional requirement, and that if we were to do otherwise, we would have a constitutional problem.
Thank you.
Representative Ackerman, we're into the judicial review.
Thank you.
And we're discussing the standing as to the appeal process.
Thank you.
Once the parties to the proceeding have been decided, which would be certainly the government, the property owner, and then anybody who was adversely affected and chose to intervene, then the local government or the state would file the record of the proceeding down below. The judicial review process would be based on that record. No additional evidence could be provided to the circuit court, with one exception I'll get to in just a second. So the government provides the record to the court. The parties work out any objections to the record, or the judge works out the objections to the record, and then the people who filed the lawsuit and anybody in support of them would file their brief, their written argument with the court as to why they think the decision was wrong. The people who want to support that decision, the local government or the state's decision, would file their brief, and then there would be oral argument. There wouldn't be any live testimony. There wouldn't be any discovery. We would just go from the record to the oral argument and a decision by the court. So in a sense, that part of the process would work similar to the LUBA process, the way that works right now. After oral argument, the judge would issue a decision. And if that decision was that the property owner is entitled to a waiver or compensation, and let's assume for the moment that the government had denied the claim, and so now the judge says property owner is entitled to a waiver of these regulations to allow this particular use or compensation, the government at that point has the option of either, in essence, agreeing to the waiver or to informing the court that it wants to pay compensation. It has to do that within 45 days of the date that the judge has issued his order, and then within 90 days after that, the government has to get its appraisal of what the reduction in value is. The government would provide that appraisal to the property owner and say, based on the appraisal, our offer to you is X dollars. The property owner at that point can say, sounds fine, write me a check. Or alternatively, if the property owner believes that that's the wrong amount, then the property owner can go get his or her own appraisal. Once the property owner gets that appraisal, and the property owner would have 90 days to get his or her own appraisal. Once the property owner does that, the property owner provides that to the government. They see whether they can work out the amount of compensation. If they can't, then it will go back to the judge, and at that point, there would be, in a sense, additional evidence. Most likely, it would be the appraisals, live testimony by the appraisers, and then after a hearing in front of the judge at that point would say, okay, here's my determination as to the amount of compensation that is due. The bill also says now explicitly that in the event that the judge decides that the amount of compensation is more than the government's appraisal, then the government has the choice to either pay that amount that the judge decided or to go back and accept the waiver. And part of what we are trying to do is to, in essence, parallel this to what's in the condemnation statutes, where, you know, government says we think the value of this taking is $100,000. Judgment turns out to be for $5 million. The government can't afford that under condemnation. The government has the ability to say, okay, you know, we're not going to take this property after all. The way this dealt with it is to say, if the amount of compensation is more than the government's appraisal, then the government can simply agree to the waiver. If the amount of compensation is the government's appraisal, then the government has to pay that amount. Any appeals from that would just go up to the Court of Appeals in the same fashion as other circuit court proceedings. That takes us through judicial review and appeals, unless the committee has some questions.
No, we appreciate, Glenn, you're taking that time to go through that area with us.
Sections 12 and 13, and now I'm back on the summary, page 3 at the top, deal with use of the waivers and transferability. And this is similar to, I believe, the dash ones. What we wanted to do here was to make it very clear how the waivers could be used, and to make it very clear when we say that waivers are, or when you say that waivers are transferable, what that means. In terms of use, a property owner, section 12, says that the property owner that received the waiver can undertake the use specified in the waiver so long as the property owner is going to comply with any conditions contained in the waiver as well as any land use regulations that have not been waived. So the property owner will still have to go through, you know, the normal land use application process, except some of the criteria of approval that would otherwise apply may be ones that have been waived. And so what the government will do is take a look at its regulations, marry that up with the waiver, and say, okay, here's the new set of approval criteria based on the waiver. And then we see whether the property owner actually gets that use. Section 13 deals with the transferability of waivers. In essence, what it says is that a waiver is transferable for a minimum of 10 years and for a longer period if the person who obtained the waiver hangs on to it for more than 10 years. So, for example, if I obtain a waiver, I can transfer that waiver to anybody within that 10-year period. They then could transfer it to anybody else if you're still within that original 10-year period. So the waiver could be transferred to 100 different people in theory as long as all those transfers take place within 10 years from the date that the government approved the waiver. It also provides, the section would also provide that if I wanted to hold on to the waiver for a longer period, I'm the one who obtained it, and I want to hold on to it for a longer time because I'm a farmer, I need to file my retroactive claim, I get my waiver, I want to be able to subdivide someday, but I want to be able to farm my land for the next 20 years before I sell it off. That what this would allow is for me to hold on to that waiver for 20 years and then transfer it. And then the person I transfer it to would have 2 years in which to undertake development under the waiver. So as the original claimant, I can hold on to it and still be able to transfer it even decades down the road. This also provides that those waivers will not expire so long as a development is undertaken within the time frame. Wanting to make clear that if I develop or I transfer it to Dan and Dan develops within that 2-year period, that once he has undertaken that development, then he is also able to transfer the developed property. So he develops an apartment building, he is able to sell that apartment building, and that person still gets the benefit of the waiver. That's how we dealt with transferability. In sections 14 and 15, we deal with areas inside the UGB. I'm going to talk about 14, and then I'm going to turn it over to Dan to talk about sections 15 through 18.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I am always about 2 steps behind Mr. Klein.
I'm sorry.
Sorry. On section 13, the description you just gave, and I'll tell you, I have not read the actual amendment. I'm not that quick. But I'm having a hard time squaring the description you just gave on the time period for transfer with the summary of Section 13 on page 3 of the summary.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, looking at the summary, waivers are transferable for a period of 10 years or 2 years after the first transfer, whichever is later. So if the first transfer takes place 20 years from now, then the waiver would expire 2 years after that 20-year period.
Why don't you use an example?
Let me jump in, Mr. Chair, for the record, Dan Cooper, Metro Attorney. I would start with an explanation that says any time a waiver is granted and the property is developed within these time periods, the waiver is never expires. So the important thing is we are dealing with the question.
That part I'm fine.
Okay.
I'm fine with.
So, all right.
If I build a house, I can sell it, and the subsequent owner gets to keep the house. I gotcha.
This is the issue on financeability we're trying to solve.
Can I take a shot? Representative Nolan.
Go ahead. Help me out here.
Farmer Jones has 80 acres that he bought in 1960. At the time Farmer Jones bought his 80 acres in 1960, he could have divided it into 10-acre parcels. Farmer Jones goes out and files a retroactive claim before September 1 of 2006, and he gets the approval to divide his property into 10-acre parcels. Under the transferability provisions, he can either take that, he can go out tomorrow and divide into 10-acre parcels and put a home on each one, or alternatively, he could transfer it to Dan, who could transfer it to Glenn, who could transfer it to me, and I could transfer it to you, and we could do that as many times as we wanted for 10 years, as long as at some point before the 10-year cutoff period, somebody went out and developed the land in the way that they were given under the waiver. Alternatively, let's say Farmer Jones doesn't want to develop the property right now. He wants to keep farming, but he has to get his claim in because we've established a September 1, 2006 cutoff date. He just as soon not develop his property now, but he wants to preserve his rights. So he would, once that waiver is given, have the ability to keep farming and to continue to own the property. And as long as he owned the property, at some point when he decided to exercise his claim, if it was 10 years down the road or 20 years down the road or 40 years, or he died and the property was passed down to his two kids or whatever, once that, if it's gone past the 10 years, once Farmer Jones decides to exercise those rights, whoever he transfers the property to has 2 years then to complete that development, or else the waiver is gone. Once the development occurs, the property is divided and the homes are placed on it or whatever, then the rights are vested and those waivers are transferable forever.
Right. And that part again. Mr. Chair, may I follow up?
Follow.
Thank you. That helps at least me understand it. Mr. Honeycutt, play it out for me with a regulation that is enacted in 2006.
Property owner would have 5 years in which to file that claim. So depending on, because it's prospective, so depending on when the property owner filed the claim, if regulation is January 1, 2006, property owner would have until January 1, 2011 to file the claim. If that's when the claim gets filed, then it will take some period of time to process it. Whenever the property owner obtains the waiver, then the property owner would have what they just went through, the 10 years from the date that they got the waiver.
Mr. Chair, if I may. So I would have to assume that every piece of property in the state, or every property owner in the state, is eligible to file a claim on a regulation enacted effective January 1, 2006. Because somebody owns the land before the regulation. legislation is enacted.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, assuming that the regulation is one that restricts the use, reduces the value
right.
of that property,
well, we wouldn't talk about it if it
yes,
wasn't.
That is correct.
If I might. And I'm trying to get my, I'm trying to capture the, what this means. A local government or the state, for any reason, enacts a regulation. Someone might claim that it affects the value of their property. Every property owner is eligible then because somebody now owns every piece of land. And they can wait 5 years before they even request a waiver, and then they could, if they're granted that waiver, then as long as that property owner owns that property, is good till they die. I'm having a hard time understanding how a government could actually do anything,
Mr. Chair,
prospectively.
Representative Nolan.
And know that it could apply it.
As I have thought about how this might play out, mm-hmm. wearing my city attorney hat, what I have been thinking about is, okay, how many regulations are we going to adopt that fall outside of the exemptions? Probably not as many as we used to. To the extent that we can fit within the exemptions, that's what we're going to try to do. To the extent we can't fit within the exemptions, then I believe local governments, and I'm assuming the state government, are going to spend a little more time thinking about the effect of the regulation on property values. And I believe that most property owners, if a government adopts a new regulation, will not be filing claims because, for the most part, those new regulations are not going to result in a significant reduction in value for that property owner, and I believe most local governments are going to have a fee. So it's going to have, the property owner is going to have to care enough to say, this has really reduced my value, so I am willing to pay the fee to go get the waiver. And again, it's not every property owner, because part of what the property owner will have to do with respect to the claim is to identify the use that they want to make of the property.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that they can just say, I think this new regulation has reduced my value, so make it go away. They're going to have to say, I want to build a fence in my backyard, and this new setback doesn't allow me to do it, and that has reduced my value, so waive the regulation to allow me to build this fence. What they would then wind up with, assuming that, you know, the exemptions didn't apply anything else, they would wind up with a piece of paper that says, in essence, this new regulation no longer prevents you from building a fence.
Mm-hmm.
Please.
Do your amendments address in any way whether regulations are to be considered in total or separately? More specifically, for example, a local government might enact a package of regulations. Some individual sections or paragraphs or pages of which create some benefit to all or certain property owners, and some of which may adversely affect some or all property owners. Do you address whether, if it is enacted as a package, the diminution in value is to be taken on the sum total of the package, or are they separable?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, if I could have just a moment, unless Dan, you have the answer.
I don't think I do.
Mr. Chair, I don't need the answer right now, but at some point I'd like to know if that's explicitly addressed here or not, or are we leaving that to some interpretation, and I would suggest we probably don't want to leave that to interpretation.
Mr. Chair,
I'd be inclined to suggest that it ought to be a package, that if it's a package, then the net impact is what we should be looking at.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, if we deal with it, we deal with it implicitly. We certainly do not deal with it explicitly.
Thanks.
Representative Ackerman. I'm still hung up on the transferability and a couple of other issues. Let me ask a couple of questions, and actually this is one that was posed to me by the chair the other night. If I am a co-owner, my co-owner is not a family member, tenants in common, am I still eligible to file a claim under the Act?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, you can file a claim, but only if all of the co-owners either sign the claim or sign something that says they approve you filing the claim. If there are two co-owners and one says, I'm not interested, I will not agree, then there cannot be a claim for that property.
Okay, thank you. Now, I'm confused on the language on the waiver process in that you stated initially that they're transferable for a period of 10 years. I interpret that to mean if I own the waiver, the property to which the waiver applies, I could transfer that property and successive owners could have a 10-year period within which to convey the property before the waiver was extinguished. Is that a proper interpretation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, what the bill language says is that it could be transferred for 10 years or up to 10 years after the date of the final decision. This is on page 16 of the bill, so that would be the government's decision under section 13 sub 1 sub A. So the 10-year period runs from the date of the government's decision.
Right.
And yes, there could be, you could transfer it to somebody on year 1, they could transfer it to somebody else on year 2, they could transfer it to somebody else on year 3.
Okay.
The way this is written, so that's
my interpretation was correct.
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I thought what you said was that with each transfer there would be another 10 years.
Well, I didn't say that.
Okay.
I mean, there's a 10-year time within which there could be successive transfers from the owner to successive owners.
Absolutely.
There would not be family members, members of the public, whatever.
Correct.
And after 10 years, that just extinguishes.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Okay. I don't know if we talked about that, but is there any consideration of what type of formality should, what type of recording should happen to, so we can identify that what land is subject to the waivers? In other words, I think you know what I mean. I don't see it in the Act, and we've talked about it kind of briefly. Is that something we should think about?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, we have changed this in the past several days to add something that says that a waiver will not be effective until it's recorded with the county and the deeds and records.
Okay, that's in the new draft then.
Right.
Okay. Maybe the summary is too much of a summary for me right now. Thank you. In one of your hypotheticals, I didn't quite follow it. You said that the waivers could continue decade after decade. Did I miss something?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, the waiver could continue if it's owned by the person who obtained it. So if,
oh, I see.
If I obtained it, I can transfer it 3 years from now or 33 years from now. If I transfer 33 years from now, it's only going to be valid for another 2 years. So somebody better make use of it quickly.
Yeah, and I don't think that's written as clear as it should be. I didn't get that construction out of it at all. And that's why I'm asking the question. I thought that it would expire in 10 years. Okay, I understand where you're coming from. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, since we're getting down to really nitty-gritty things here, let me make sure. And I haven't looked at the actual words of the amendment. I'm looking at mostly at your summary. The clock for your 10 years starts ticking the day the government issues its final, whatever state or local issues a final order. But the person who receives the waiver can't act on it until, well, if they transfer it, the new owner can't act on it until the transfer is recorded. Is that a correct understanding?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, the waiver itself will not become valid until it has been recorded on the property. I don't believe we put anywhere in here, although you might want to think about doing that, to say that when it's transferred to somebody else, that something should be recorded. So if I get a waiver on January 1, my 10 years begins to run on January 1, but I can't take advantage of the waiver until it gets recorded with the county.
At your initiation?
At my initiation.
Okay. Great.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, I think we're operating on the assumption that when the new owner accepts the transfer, he's going to get a deed that will be recorded or some form of evidence of his new ownership. And what we're trying to do is clearly indicate that when he acquires the property, the waiver transfers with it if it's within these time frames. Now, we may want to go back and make sure we've tied that knot in the drafting.
Mr. Sheridan, Section 14 applies inside the urban growth boundaries, and it applies to retroactive claims only. In order to have a retroactive claim inside a UGB, in addition to the regulation restricting the use, being a land use regulation, not being exempt, reducing the value, in addition to all those things, it also has to meet this additional test or alternative test. Either the regulation must have been enacted, and the language we use here is pursuant to rules of LCDC to protect riparian areas, wetland, wildlife habitat, or natural areas. And I'm on page 17 of the bill. So in essence, it has to have been enacted as a Goal 5 protection measure, or it has to have limited the developable area of the parcel based on aesthetics, environmental, or natural qualities. And then we have another sentence that says, and by that we do not mean a design review code, because someone said, well, aesthetics is that design review. So it has to meet those, and one last qualification, it has to be for a residential use. So if you're inside the urban growth boundary, you meet all the initial restrictions on what's a Measure 37 claim. In addition, if what you want to do is a residential use, then you can seek a waiver if the regulation is either a Goal 5 protection measure for riparian areas, wetland, wildlife habitat, or natural areas, or it's something like a Goal 5 protection measure, but it's not called that. But the regulation limits the developable area based on aesthetics, environmental, or natural qualities. Those will be the restrictions for retroactive claims inside the urban growth boundary. And if there are no questions on that, then I'll turn it over to Dan.
It's more of a policy question on the pursuant to the rules of the Land Conservation Development Commission, protecting riparian areas, wetlands, wildlife habitat. Are you saying that that's the type of regulation that has restricted the use of property that we're looking to that would be waived?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, if the regulation that one is seeking a waiver for was one of these things, then you could seek a waiver. And met all the other criteria.
No, I understand that. Okay. I'm just questioning the policy behind waiving those types of regulations, that's all. Thank you.
Just within UGBs?
Pardon?
Just within UGBs?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Dan Cooper, I'm going to start with on page 17 or the section 15 in the outline and talk about the areas immediately outside UGBs and then the areas beyond that. As we walk through our exercise of sorting out issues on the Measure 37 issue, it became apparent that there's a lot of concern about areas immediately around the urban growth boundary of cities in the metro area, particularly in those areas of the state where growth is occurring and there is pressure on the urban growth boundary. And in those areas, land values are appreciating substantially because of the potential that they could be urbanized in the future, as well as the fact that Measure 37 claims, if approved and resulted in waivers, could produce low density residential development patterns, which would have a couple of negative impacts on future urbanization. One, they could put low density development around an urban growth boundary, which would make the provisions of services to areas that you would urbanize further out much more expensive and harder to do. And second, they create a conflict between the land use laws, which say you move the urban growth boundaries outward and provide services, and annexation laws, which require voter approval from areas to be annexed to cities. And as areas are developed with low density residential patterns, those people tend not to like to vote to be annexed and have their property taxes increase. So with those two things in play, as well as the increase in value, we work through a mechanism that we think will protect property the fairness element to property owners who have Measure 37 claims in this buffer zone we're creating. At the same time, allow for some orderly decisions to be made about future urbanization in those areas of the state where there are pressures on the urban growth boundary. So we start off with an idea of allowing every urban area, every city in the metro area in the state, a brief timeout of 9 months to decide whether or not there's pressure on the urban growth boundary and they're going to take advantage of this provision at all, or, and if so, to what extent and where. And in that 9 month period, we have a two-step process where the cities outside of Metro would select potential study areas that they might be interested in, and the county they're contained in would then review that decision and determine whether or not that study area should be larger or not. And once the county makes its final decision, that land within that study area, Measure 37 claims, still would be made and processed and determine their validities. But the effective date of the waiver and the effective date of the time frames on transferability would be put on hold for a period of time until there was a determination whether the land was going to come into an urban growth boundary or not. In the metro region, that process would be similar, except the three counties in the metro region would take the first cut after consulting with their cities as to what that study area would be within this two-mile buffer zone, and then Metro would have a final say as to whether we thought there needed to be additional land. Now, it's important to recognize that this provision explicitly says this is not a factor. The ultimate decision on the urban growth boundary will be made consistent with current law at that time as to whatever it is, and this does not create an obligation to move an urban growth boundary in any place or preclude urban growth boundary expansions outside of these study areas if that's what the later determination is. So it's not a prejudgment of that decision. It's a mechanism to put the Measure 37 claims on hold while things sort out.
Dan, how long?
Well, the bill says until 2015. We struggled with that, and one of our initial recommendations was that while we think that's an outside limit, we recognize that if this pattern were to continue, there is a potential for some unfairness in some parts of the state if those lines are set too big and there is no real movement of an urban growth boundary that time period. We've done two things on that. One is to allow property owners within that zone who want to the right to proceed on at least some large, very large lot development during that interim period. But we also had an initial recommendation that we thought we were going to be making, that the legislature create an interim committee to look at this issue, to come back to you next session for you to have the opportunity to say, you know, that 2015 date is too long, or there's something else you need to do on this to hurry the process up in particular areas or make it happen more expeditiously. We didn't make that recommendation to you because we think there are probably other issues that you would want to look at as well during the interim, and we didn't want to make a recommendation that said, just look at this one narrow issue. There may be a lot of other issues. We would hope that a process would be set up during the interim to look at that issue and potentially other issues, both related to Measure 37 and other land use issues around the state as well. But we weren't comfortable just being the ones to recommend a specific one to you. We think there's another process in this building going on that may sort that out, and if it does, then this would be a natural issue for that process to address as well.
Let me just ask you, under two different scenarios, on property that's just outside an urban growth boundary, if somebody wanted to locate on, say, 50 acres today, you might go out and try to piece one property owner at a time and purchase that property. Under this, could somebody actually merge multiple owners into one Measure 37 claim?
No. This wouldn't allow, Mr. Chair, for aggregating of claims into a larger claim at this time. They would be treated outside the urban growth boundary. I'm going to get to the Section 17 and 18, what we're providing for in general outside urban growth boundaries, which would be the next level out, in which, you know, all we're doing here is just putting them on hold and allowing them the same rights they would have under Section 17 and 18 otherwise, but just putting those rights on hold.
I would just have one more question again. How arbitrary was this 15-year period? I mean, where did that come from?
It's 10 years.
10 years. I always like to add more years to those things.
It kind of parallels the waiver period that you're proposing.
Well,
maybe it was designed that way?
And maybe it wasn't.
I'm trying to give you some credit here, gentlemen.
It was long enough for the legislature to think about new rules on urban growth boundary and perhaps start a new cycle of urban growth boundary amendments in the Portland region by 2009, and then allow a second round 5 or 6 years later to follow it through. So if it didn't come in two cycles, then it was presumptively not going to come in. But I don't think we're particularly wedded to that date, as long as it's far enough ahead of time out so that there's a holding period for these things to be sorted out and have some idea of what the impacts would be.
Given the past history, and this is primarily for a guy from Klamath Falls, how often have urban growth boundaries been expanded within the metro district?
Well, we've gone through the process, it seems, continuously since about 1997, and I guess that means three or four times since then. And we're anticipating we're looking at another major look at it within 2 to 4 years.
So it's pretty often.
It's pretty often. Before that time, it was not frequent at all. Around the rest of the state before then, I think there was a major change in the urban growth boundary in Brookings, and the rest of the urban growth boundaries around the state were very stable through the 1980s and 1990s. I understand right now that there's pressure on the urban growth boundary in the Bend area. I don't think you're in the Eugene Springfield area looking at it right now, but I can't say that for certain. In the Kaiser area, there certainly has been some expansion recently for commercial purposes. It's one of the factors, if I digress a little bit, when Senate Bill 100 was set up and comprehensive plans were drawn and urban growth boundaries established around the 1980 time frame, the theory was everybody was going to have at least a 20-year supply of land available, which would have implied that if everything had gone as planned, everybody should have been looking at their urban growth boundaries about 2000. Or sooner as land developed, but because of maybe they were drawn a lot larger than a 20-year supply turned out to be, given the economy went in the tank in the 1980s, and has been very uneven and not good in many parts of the state. There isn't a lot of pressure on urban growth boundaries in Klamath Falls, and I don't know whether I'd wish for you that there was or wasn't, having gone through the experience myself, but if your economy was doing what your Chamber of Commerce wanted, you would have pressure on your urban growth boundary.
Correct. Please proceed.
Okay. Section 17 and 18 are in the outline are labeled provisions for rural areas, and I want to start with telling you what the outline talks about, but what the reality is. Outside urban growth boundaries, land fairly sorts out into three different categories, and what Section 17 and 18 are referring to is only one of those categories. The categories of lands outside urban growth boundaries are exception lands, rural residential and rural commercial, industrial in a limited basis, rural unincorporated communities are all exception lands where the process has said goals 3 and goal 4 do not apply, and rural level of development is allowed under state law, and with few exceptions except around the ring of urban growth boundaries, there's no real state regulation of those lands. It's county regulation. Minimum lot size is established by the state of 2 acres. Many counties have larger minimum lot sizes in those lands. For those lands, we would leave Measure 37 to allow retroactive claims filed by September 2006, and property owners would have a right to develop those lands if waivers are granted and compensation isn't paid, to do anything they could do at the time they acquired the property, and we would have no further limits in this proposed bill. Likewise, in a second category of land, which are non-resource lands, Klamath County has determined that, consistent with state law, there's substantial acreage, which is now categorized as non-resource. It's not rural residential or rural industrial, but it's not farm, forest, or mixed farm and forest land. So in those categories of land, property owners could either do what's allowed under current law or do what they would have been allowed to do at the time they acquired if there's a restriction in between, and we don't deal with that land. What we're going to deal with in here is the entire category of resource land outside urban growth boundaries, and that's any land for which there is an exclusive farm use zone, an exclusive forestry zone, or a mixed forest and farm zone. And those are lands that are restricted by both county regulations and current state law and regulation to preclude anything but farm or forest uses. And that long list of uses that are allowed in those zones that's set out in ORS Chapter 215, which the legislature has approved from time to time. In that category of land, the following property owners with Measure 37 status would have two options. One is to apply for a tract of record under a statutory proceeding by which they would just simply establish that they want to build a single dwelling on a tract, and that the tract was legally created, and at the time they acquired the tract, that is something they were entitled to do. And they can elect to do that, and if they do that, they just proceed basically as a straight land use decision. They have to establish the date of their ownership and that they had the right to build on the date of their ownership, and they may proceed. Or we may elect to file a Measure 37 claim consistent with the claims process that Glenn outlined. And for those claims, we've agreed on some substantial limitations on what those claims can produce in those resource lands. And these limitations would apply to any resource land, and we do not propose to differentiate between high-quality farm land, other farmland, grapes, hay, orchards, or any of those different categories. We propose that you would treat all resource land the same for this purpose. In those areas, property owners, depending on the size of the tract they own, would have an opportunity to proceed with a claim. If the property owner owned a 20-acre parcel or less, subtract or less, they could proceed to seek a waiver to allow 5 acre lots, or up to 5 acre lots, so they could have, they could divide their 20 into 4 different lots and proceed. They would be limited to uses on those lots that were one well, one residential size septic tank, and only one of those 4 lots could develop for a commercial or industrial purpose. Otherwise, they'd be residential lots. If they own a parcel larger than 20 acres, they could file a claim for creation of new lots with an average, based on one new lot for every 10 acres. The lots would be sized as 2-acre lots and would need to be clustered so that they were in one section of the property, and the remainder of the property would continue as resource land, and there would be a deed covenant recorded at the time of the partition to make sure that any subsequent owner knew that when they acquired that land, that that land, the remnant, would continue to be in resource status. But on in the cluster, they would be allowed to have residential uses, except that one of those lots could also be a small-scale commercial or industrial parcel on that one single lot. Now, here we deal with the question of, in some parts of the state, 2 acres may not be enough to have a good septic tank. So if the property owner can demonstrate that on his property 2-acre lots won't produce buildable lots with septic tanks, we're going to allow those lots to go up to 3-acre size if necessary to expand that cluster so that all of the individual lots can have a septic tank if necessary. But that's going to be the burden of the claimant to show that he's got a septic tank problem, and this limited expansion of the lots is the appropriate relief for it.
There are different types of septic systems.
Yes.
And there's sand, which will work some in some areas, and is now being recommended, I think, 80% of the time. Does this take into account the various types of septic systems?
We're leaving that to the health regulation mechanism. The bill doesn't address different types. We're saying you have to have no community sewer, no package treatment plant, no large-scale sewage disposal systems on these lots, but each lot has to support its own septic system. So if the technology is best with a sand filter, fine. If that means you get to do something on a lot that you couldn't do within this acreage limitation, then you get to use that technology to do it if it's something that is standard for a residential use. So if the technology improves and makes areas of the state that right now you can't put a septic tank in available to have septic tanks, then people will be able to take advantage of that. Our concern is the community sewer, community water issue.
Correct.
Okay. Oh, yes. The septic tank and well issue, Glenn's pointed out, is something that applies in all of the land outside of urban growth boundaries. So the exception lands and the non-resource lands still have to have a well and a septic tank on them. The lot limitation and the clustering are what we're proposing for the resource lands. Now, if your property is large enough that under this you're entitled to more than a 10-lot cluster, we're proposing that those lots, the waivers, while they need to be adjudicated and determined and recorded, the effective date for purposes of construction be delayed until December 31st, 2007, so that the next legislature has an opportunity to know how many of those claims have actually been filed and found to be valid, and to make whatever judgment you choose to make at that time, consistent with available funding sources as you determine, to either compensate some of those owners so they don't proceed to develop, or if you don't compensate them, then at the end of that time period, those waivers would be valid, and
then the owners could develop them. And move the transferability deadlines of the 10 years and the 2 years forward so that those property owners don't lose that 2 years waiting for you to make a decision. They'd have their rights pushed forward. Now, in addition, we would have, because there are some very large parcels out there that are in common ownership of 1,000 acres or more, there would be a 100-unit cap on any claim. So a very large property owner could not take advantage of this provision and end up with what amounted to a very low-density city someplace outside of an urban growth boundary. They would be limited to 100 or more, not 100 or less. I think that covers it, unless, Dave, I've left something out.
Mr. Chair, the other thing of significance to note in Section 18 is that retroactive claims made under the Forest Practices Act would also be eliminated. So, in other words, a property owner who lost harvestability on a portion of the property as a result of a Forest Practices Act, a regulation under the Forest Practices Act that was created after they purchased the property, would lose their retroactive claim under the Forest Practices Act.
And for those of you either on the committee or behind me who may have been following through on the bill draft we handed out, on page 20, section 18, subsection C, does not represent what I said clearly because we have not completed drafting it. So don't ignore the language in section 18, sub C, on page 20, and what I described in terms of 10 and 20s and the time periods is what we expect to have by the time we turn in our draft to Legislative Council.
Any other questions
on section 17 or 18? Gordon. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me your concern is to preserve open space, open land, and yet you're putting a limit in number that I didn't see in the measure. Wouldn't it be more reasonable to say, if you're really trying to limit to the size of the parcel, maybe 10 acres, 20 acres, 5 acres, whatever. But I didn't sense in the measure itself, in the initiative, that we're going to cap people from building. Yeah, I suppose in a sense you do cap them by limiting the number of acres, but if you're trying to create openness, a fairly large parcel of 10 or 20 acres is doing that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't believe that, except in the case of a very large landowner, you will see applications for developments of more than 100 units outside of urban growth boundaries in any event, under Measure 37 or otherwise. And so we're certainly we're comfortable with number one, the ten dwelling off ramp, the immediate ability of people to get to qualify for 10 units, provided they could have done so under the law in effect at the time they bought the land, based on the theory that takes care of, I guess for lack of a better term, the families, the little widow types, the small property owners, and at the same time we're also comfortable with the 100 cap on the theory that it would be rare under Measure 37 that you'd have a development application approved for more than 100 units in any event. And as Mr. Cooper indicated, the goal here was to stop somewhere short of the creation of extremely large low density development.
Tell me again, and this would be going back to, I'm not sure if it was in 17, I think it might have been the last one, you're thinking against new technology. You have a small package system in 4 or 5 clustered homes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the thinking was not against new technology, but against higher intensity development. And the limitation to the single system is a mechanism to say a home, a commercial that is of the puts the same constraints on a septic system as a house does is acceptable intensity in a rural area. If you have larger scale development, then you don't have a limit on how intense that commercial or industrial development may be in the rural area. And, you know, that may be one of the things you end up looking at down the road, is that if you have a mechanism for dealing with the rural development staying its rural character with cheaper technology, I don't think anybody has heartburn over that. It's how do we make sure that we're dealing with rural-style development rather than urban-style development outside of urban growth boundaries.
I think I would rather see treatment capacity that doesn't put septic in the ground than to have 10 or 12 or 8 or 10 septic tanks that could fail and really change the aquifer in that area pretty severely. It seems to me with some of the new technology we might be much wiser from a safety and health standpoint, and maybe that's something that the local county should be looking at because they know their soils and they might be better able to deal with the different proposals.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that was a debate, if you think back 3 or 4 months, that we had with House Bill 2705, which got out of here and got off the floor, but is now sitting over in the, I think it died over in the Senate Land Use Committee. So that is a...
Like everything else.
That is something it's something that the committee might want to consider again.
Any further comments?
I have a comment. Just a comment to what Mr. Honeycutt said. If you feel comfortable and there isn't any chance that anybody's going to put these developments in, why would you have a cap?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, to the extent that the cap provides assurance to folks that have votes in this building and other people, other interested parties that are concerned about the scale of development, the possible scale of development outside of urban growth boundaries, I think we're hopeful that this cap would provide them with some type of assurance that that won't be the case. And I represent, as most of you know, not the big guys, but the little rural guys and gals. Most of the claims that we handle would be, or the people that we represent would be people who would fall well under that 100 cap.
Thank you.
You want to wrap her up, Brent?
Mr. Chair, I will do that. We're just about done. Sections 19 and 20, and I'm back on page 3 of the summary. Sections 19 and 20 are just conforming amendments related to LUBA jurisdiction and to actions that appraisers would be authorized to take. Sections 21 through 25 would authorize local governments and boundary commissions to require a property owner that's coming to a local government requesting to be annexed to a city or requesting a comprehensive plan amendment or requesting a zone change, it would allow the local government to require the property owner to relinquish any Measure 37 rights that the individual would have with respect to regulations existing as of the date of the application. So that if a property owner says, I want to join the city, the property owner, I mean, the policy embedded in here is if the property owner says, I want to join the city, the property owner should accept the regulations that are in effect at the time that the property owner joins the city. Or alternatively, if a property owner says, I want my property rezoned from residential to commercial, and there are some restrictions in place on commercial property that after the property owner has owned the property but before it got zoned to commercial, if the property owner says, I want to be rezoned to commercial, the property owner ought to accept the restrictions in place as of the date that the property owner says, please rezone me. So that's what Sections 21 through 25 are intended to do. Section 26 I already talked about, and Section 27 just says, please do this with an emergency clause. And that's a run through of the bill.
Thank you for a lot of hard work. There'll be a test tomorrow. My apologies to those who had the dash sixes and sevens. We will get to those tomorrow. My apologies there. But I do thank this panel and John and Lane and Dave for coming with this and presenting it to the committee. As you indicated earlier to us, there are still going to be amendments to the amendments, and we will look forward to your return. We look forward to hopefully having a finished product to choose from, for this committee to choose from, within the next few days and by the end of the week, so that early next week we can begin the process of actually putting this bill together. I thank you for your efforts. Committee, I thank you for your efforts, and we will adjourn until 1:15 tomorrow. 1:15.